Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the View from the Thorax Center for Radcliffe Cardiology. This is the wrap-up of the 2024 ACC meeting. I'm Nicolas van Mieghem, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend and colleague Jos Dame to discuss what was hot as a late-breaker trial at one of the big meetings, this time the ACC. Jos, let's kick off with Ultimate DAPT.
Yeah, so this was a great meeting, actually. A lot of interesting trials were presented. A lot of publications, I have to say, in New England, Lancet simultaneously, one in CIRC. So a lot of good stuff to be presented. Well, first trial we would like to highlight is the combined trial Ultimate DAPT and IVUS ACS, which was a prospective multicenter randomized placebo-controlled trial designed to determine, one, whether IVUS-guided PCI would result in superior outcome as compared to angio-guided PCI in patients presenting with acute coronary syndrome. And second, whether a ticagrelor monotherapy 1 month after an event-free period after ACS would be superior in terms of bleeding as compared to a DAPT strategy in patients post-ACS. So Greg Stone presented the Ultimate DAPT trial, which was the ticagrelor part, and as anticipated, a significant reduction in bleeding in those who were taken off their aspirin after 1 month, a highly significant 55% reduction in bleeding as defined by either BARC 2, 3, or 5. No significant interaction in any of the 12 pre-specified subgroups. As predicted, similar and low MACE rates at of 3.6 versus 3.7%. Although, and that's directly the comment that I would like to make, the investigators anticipated event rates of above 6%. So as already anticipated a little bit, event rates that were half as compared to what they expected in this Asian trial. However, due to the substantial difference in the bleeding outcome, a 32% reduction in MACE, which was the net adverse clinical outcome, clearly favoring stopping aspirin at 1 month of an event-free period after an ACS. This paper was published simultaneously online in the Lancet, and I think is another step forward in tailoring down the DAPT, or let's say platelet strategy in patients at 1 month post-PCI, specifically in case there are more potent agents like prasugrel or ticagrelor.
Somehow not much novelty.
I agree. But again, now also an Asian trial, and mind you, this is the first placebo-controlled trial to address this issue. So I think that's a definite strength of this trial. Then conversely, also the IVUS ACS trials were presented. So this was the IVUS part of the trial. As anticipated, a 45% reduction in target vessel failure in patients that underwent IVUS-guided PCI as compared to angio-guided PCI. Event rates 7.3 versus 4% at 1 year, favoring the IVUS arm. So a little bit as anticipated. However, I think the only remark for this trial, and that also counts a little bit for the Ultimate DAPT, is that less than one out of three patients actually presented with STEMI. So within this trial, there were a lot of patients with high-risk unstable angina, as they called it, so they had no troponins, but high-risk features like 90% stenosis or persistent angina, etc. So that makes the novelty of the IVUS ACS trial a little bit less to me, because this is more or less in line with all the data on IVUS we have, again illustrating the superiority, but perhaps not completely addressing whether a IVUS-guided strategy is also the way forward in patients actually presenting with thrombotic lesions in a STEMI setting. So that, I think, still leaves room for future studies on the topic.
Well, I think it needs to be confirmed in Caucasians, for instance, because this obviously was an Asian population. Yeah. And then, you know, there are other imaging modalities, right? Yeah, this is all focusing on IVUS, but I think OCT can also be a very potent technique in patients with thrombotic lesions, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the RELIEF HF. Yeah. So we switch gear. We go to the heart failure setting. And again, Greg Stone was presenting, this time on this interatrial shunting device. The ambition was to demonstrate safety and efficacy in patients with heart failure. Both HFpEF and HFrEF patients were eligible for the study, provided they were symptomatic. 500 patients were enrolled. The mean ejection fraction of those patients was 45%. Mm-hmm. 40% were considered to be HFrEF, with an ejection fraction less than 40%. And almost all patients were in New York Heart Class 3. The follow-up was up to 2 years. Well, the primary efficacy endpoint was a hierarchical composite that started at death at one end and an improvement in KCCQ, quality of life, on the other. And at the end of the day, it turned out to be a negative trial. And, you know, it's not the first of its kind. We also know from the reduced LAP-HF2 trial that it will not be easy to find superiority using interatrial shunting. But this, again, was a negative trial, although there was a signal in favor of using interatrial shunting in patients with HFrEF. I was a little bit surprised to find that potential advantage in HFrEF patients. I was more under the impression that the field was moving towards HFpEF and the application of interatrial shunting in patients with HFpEF, especially with this sub-analysis from the reduced LAP trial that found in HFpEF patients without signals of, or signs of pulmonary hypertension, this interatrial shunting concept would work. Well, now we all of a sudden get a different perspective. It is the patients with HFrEF that would be eligible for this this kind of therapy. I think it is confusing. I think what also of somewhat interest is that the patients who were included in RELIEF-HF, they had higher pulmonary filling pressures, higher pulmonary pressures than the patients in the reduced LAP. So if you look at the pulmonary vascular resistance, we know from the reduced LAP that those with a pulmonary vascular resistance below 1.7 Wood's units, those were the responders. Well, on average, the pulmonary vascular resistance was 2.1 Wood's units in RELIEF-HF. So that might contribute to the fact that this patient, this study ended to be a negative. But at the end of the day, if we are looking at two negative trials where we have to that we have to dive in to find like a niche of responders to interatrial shunting, I'm wondering what the future will hold. We have two other randomized studies, the LA-HF and the Responder-HF, but I don't think that it's going to be a big market, to be honest.
No, I tend to agree. I mean, this is one of the invasive concepts that may help us to treat specific diseases. Think renal denervation, think reducer, think these V-wave systems. I mean, there's so many new device-based therapies to improve heart failure, HFpEF, which is largely hypertension, it's pulmonary hypertension. So it's a mixed bag of indications that may in specific patient entities respond different to the therapy. I'm not convinced yet.
Yeah, well, a similar presentation was maybe the Orbita Cosmic.
Yeah, Orbita Cosmic was the trial of the Orbita group led by Rachel Lamy from London, which was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial ran in 6 UK sites. Performed to assess whether the coronary sinus reducer reduced daily episodes of angina and myocardial blood flow in patients with refractory angina. So basically 51 patients were randomized.
51,
yeah, small trial. 25 to the reducer versus 26 to the sham arm. 86% was male, 60% diabetes. Most of these patients were in CCS class 3, using on average 3 anti-anginal medications. And these patients underwent extensive screening at baseline using, I think, at least 10 scales for the KCCQ, Seattle Angina Questionnaire, stress testing, treadmill testing, and a MR perfusion scan to test for differences in stress MR perfusion at baseline versus 6 months in both arms. So guess what? The primary endpoint was the count in the number of daily episodes of angina, which appeared to be statistically in favor of those who actually got the real device, so the reducer versus placebo or the sham arm. However, in 10 of the 11 other Quality of life endpoints, no significant differences were observed. Second, in the MR endpoint, no change at all was observed in terms of myocardial perfusion grade in ischemic territories. And finally, what I thought was a striking finding within this trial with an invasive device is that there were 3 device failures, which is 12% in a trial of this size is substantial. So assuming a very small treatment effect in patients that at the end overall almost all remained symptomatic at 6 months, would to me not warrant a costly procedure with a 12% failure rate. So I honestly foresee little take up for this technology in the present form, but we'll see. This paper was published in Lancet simultaneously.
That puzzles me. I mean, we're talking about 51 patients with a soft endpoint of angina symptoms, and that is Lancet worthy. And then also as a late breaker at ACC, don't get me wrong, I think those group of investigators have a long track record, but
it's a small trial. I think the credits to the investigators, because this again is a trial that tries to assess, in this case, the true mechanism of action of this device, in which there were a lot of unknowns and how this device actually works. So with that, I think running a study with 51 patients, stress perfusion MRI, two time points is difficult to do. And that attests to the quality, but conversely, I totally agree. It's a very small study, soft endpoint, with no difference in the thing they actually wanted to know, and that was the MR.
But and we are looking for trials here that really would affect our practice.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the next trial. I think MPACT MI. Mm-hmm. That's a different beast because that trial was looking into the value of using SGLT2 inhibitors in the context of patients early after a myocardial infarction. And we know that up to 30% of patients will eventually develop heart failure within 1 year after an acute MI. So this definitely is a relevant question, and this is a substantial trial. No. More than 6,500 patients were enrolled. All these patients had a STEMI or a non-STEMI with signs of congestion or ejection fraction below 45% within 2 weeks of the ACS. And there were also high-risk features that needed to be present, either atrial fibrillation or elevated NT-proBNP diabetes, or the ejection fraction could be even worse. 57% of the patients had symptoms of congestion, 78% of the patients had an ejection fraction below 45%, 3/4 with a non-STEMI. Well, these were relatively sick patients, definitely no question there. And the primary endpoint of the trial was a composite of time to first heart failure hospitalization or all-cause mortality. And patients were then one-to-one randomized to either empagliflozin or placebo. I was surprised because this was a negative trial altogether. So we did see reductions in first and total heart failure hospitalizations, but the primary composite endpoint was no different between the two treatment arms. And interestingly, if you then look back at the DAPA-MI, one of the trials that we discussed earlier, well, also there was no effect on the composite of death and heart failure hospitalizations. It was all focusing on heart failure hospitalization. So in conclusion, I think patients in the context of a recent MI are not your mainstream chronic heart failure patients. No. It's a different patient population, and they have different issues at hand, especially early following their event. Because then we're talking about thrombosis or reinfarction, stent thrombosis, the need for maybe stent-related issues. And you will not affect that with an SGLT2 inhibitor. So I think for the time being, we should not be putting all our STEMI patients or non-STEMI patients on an SGLT2 inhibitor. But you have to follow up these patients, because when they are developing or transitioning to chronic heart failure, then they enter a different phase of their disease. And that is where SGLT2 inhibitors will kick in.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I totally agree. I think the enrollment criteria for the trial were perhaps a little bit too liberal. I mean, somebody with a non-STEMI, I mean, of course, they needed to have, for instance, if they had a non-STEMI and AFib, they could be enrolled, even if the ejection fraction was 60%. So
But yeah, those were underrepresented, right? Most patients had ejection fractions less than 45.
At the end, I think, as you say, this may have diluted a little bit the treatment effect, specifically in this day and age in which we're able to treat STEMIs within 90 minutes, non-STEMIs within 24 hours. The number of patients with acute heart failure post-STEMI or even HFpEF is perhaps somewhat lower than 10, 20 years ago. But okay.
But I think it's an important trial. And another trial that we wanted to highlight was the REDUCE AMI trial, again in the AMI setting. And it's again a trial that puts perspective to protocolized medicine. Because nowadays, in patients who are admitted with an acute myocardial infarction, I think they all will get some beta-blocking agents. And the question is that still validated, and should we be doing that kind of protocolized medicine? Well, this is what was studied by our colleagues from Sweden in their enormous Sweetheart registry. They had again a registry-based, randomized, parallel, open-label, multi-center trial to look into the effect of beta-blocking agents after or in the context of a recent myocardial infarction. And patients were eligible if they had an acute MI and needed a coronary angiogram. The interesting part there is they had to have an ejection fraction above 50%. Mean age of the patients was 65 years old, 1 in 5 were women. 95% underwent PCI, 4% CABG. Only 1% had no stenosis. So those were the Minocas. And I also find that of interest. So that tells you how rare Minoca is, right? Only 1% of the patients with an acute MI. We're talking about more than 5,000 patients. So this is definitely an interesting finding. But then the follow-up was 3.5 years. So patients were either randomized to placebo or to beta-blocking agents. And the beta-blocker could be metoprolol, aiming for 100 milligrams, or bisoprolol, aiming for 5 milligrams per day. And 82% of the patients in the treatment cohort were still on a beta blocker at 1 year follow-up. At the end of the day, no difference in terms of the primary composite endpoint of death, recurrent MI, or any of the secondary endpoints. There was zero benefit of prescribing beta blockers in these patients with preserved ejection fraction after their MI. And I also find one of the takeaways for me at least was that this trial also offered a benchmark in terms of the annual primary event rate. It was only 2.5%. So the composite of all-cause death and recurrent MI, only 2.5% per year, very low.
Yeah, that's true. It's a little bit what we alluded to. The benefit of beta blockers in this setting is mainly based on trials that looked in a peri-MI setting. But on the long run, we know that adherence rates are relatively low, around 50%. Of course, investigators mentioned that 80% was still on beta blockers, but whether they were truly adherent is unknown. And specifically in those with preserved ejection fraction, I'm not really surprised. But it's good we now have a trial that at least illustrates that we should step away from routinely prescribing these drugs to everybody. So that is important.
Yeah, that's good to revisit all these protocols, right? Absolutely. And now we have the randomized trials to add perspective and then also modify these protocols. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the structural heart space. And we had two very interesting trials related to TAVI. The first one was the DEDICATE trial, which was a randomized study run by our colleagues in Hamburg. So this was not an industry-sponsored trial. It was a randomized controlled trial evaluating TAVI versus SAVR in low to intermediate operative risk patients. Patients had to be above 65 years old. More than 1,400 patients were randomized, one-to-one. The mean age was 74 years old. Their STS was 1.8%. 12% of the patients were below 70 years. The trial was done in 38 German sites, and it took 5 years to enroll all the patients. So there is some selection bias, but that said, this trial was run by good German interventionalists and cardiac surgeons.
But 1,400 TAVIs, that's quite the procedures, I have to say. That's a lot.
That's but in 5 years, 38 sites, you have these big sites in Germany.
That's true.
Important exclusion criteria for this trial was bicuspid aortic stenosis and coronary artery disease. So these were all patients with isolated severe aortic valve stenosis. In the TAVI arm, any commercially available product was allowed. That resulted in 61% of the patients receiving a balloon expandable valve, 35% a self-expanding system. And then for the surgical arm, also of interest, 51% had a conventional full sternotomy. Partial sternotomy was performed in 39%, and sutureless valves were used in 16% of the patients. So this was really reflecting everyday practice in Germany. That's why it is such a relevant trial. Also, so if you look at the discharge after the procedure, well, 3/4 of the patients after TAVI were discharged home, and versus only 40% after surgery. The other patients were sent to a rehabilitation center. Obviously, that is an important observation when you would consider economics. Well, at the end of the day, TAVI was non-inferior to surgery as measured by the composite endpoint of all-cause mortality or stroke at 1 year. Was 5.4% for TAVI versus 10% for surgery. And if we then look at mortality, it was 2.6% for TAVI versus 6.2% for surgery. So this was a 60% reduction in terms of mortality in favor of TAVI. And also there was a clear trend towards lower stroke rates with a stroke rate of 2.9% after TAVI versus 4.7% for surgery. If you look at disabling stroke, 1.3% for TAVI versus 3.1% for surgery. There was more new onset atrial fibrillation, 3 times more after surgery, whereas the pacemaker rate was double as high with TAVI as compared to surgery. So I think this is an important trial. Why? Because this is not sponsored by industry. So all the criticisms that, for instance, the Dutch Zorg Institute always mentions that yes, but all these trials that are used to formulate the guidelines are all industry driven. Well, this is investigator-driven research, very important, and at the end of the day, it shows the exact same thing. If not, it amplifies what we already learned from the other pivotal randomized trials in this arena. So I think very important study, well done by our German colleagues. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you will get the criticism now that, yeah, but the surgical mortality is too high. The surgical mortality at 1 year was 6.2%. Well, if you compare it to the STS database, there was a recent publication. They looked at all the isolated surgical aortic valve replacements in the United States. 1 year mortality was 2.6%. Well, that is an observation in the United States, but this is where I think patient selection becomes also relevant. And for the patients that were selected in this German trial, who were considered not all low risk, but also intermediate risk, well, those patients were evaluated by the multidisciplinary heart teams, by a screening committee. Well, in those patients, TAVI was outperforming surgery.
Yeah, nothing to add to that. It's as the headline said about this trial, not a win for TAVI. I think that concludes it all.
Yeah. Then the other interesting trial with TAVI was the SMART trial. This was a Medtronic-sponsored trial that was presented by our good friend Howie Herman. It was evaluating balloon-expandable TAVI with a Sapien valve versus self-expanding TAVI with the Evolut valve in patients with small anatomies. And small anatomies are not trivial. Allegedly, it's about one in three of all the TAVI patients have small anatomies, and the primary objective of primary objectives of this trial were twofold. One was to demonstrate clinical non-inferiority between the two treatment strategies. The other one was to look for superiority in terms of hemodynamic valve performance in favor of the Evolut valve. 716 patients were randomized 1-to-1 in 83 sites. 87% of the patients were women, and the mean SDS score was 3.3%. The small anatomy was defined by an area below 430 millimeters square, and it turned out the mean area was 380 millimeters square. So definitely small anatomies were identified and included in the study. The majority of the patients were treated either with an S323 or an Evolut 26 as expected. So there was no difference in the clinical endpoint. So if you look at the composite of mortality, disabling stroke or heart failure, rehospitalization, no difference. numerically more pacers with the self-expanding valve versus the balloon expandable valves, 12% versus 7.8%. No surprises there. What was a surprise, if we looked at aortic regurgitation, it seems to be more common with the balloon expandable system as compared with the self-expanding system. And that was, for me at least, a surprise. And then the other primary endpoint was the endpoint of bioprosthetic valve dysfunction. Bioprosthetic valve dysfunction included in that definition a mean gradient above 20 millimeters of mercury, the presence of prosthesis patient mismatch. Yeah. Well, it turned out that this valve dysfunction occurred in 41% of the patients with the Sapien valve versus 9% versus the self-expanding valve. And that is a landslide. So, but then the question is, but how relevant is this endpoint? Mm-hmm. Because it did not have any consequence in terms of the clinical outcomes, at least at 1 year. So I think it is very important to do a follow-up and to keep following this trial for the 5 year and even the 10 year outcome data, because then we will be able to connect the dots. Is this endpoint of bioprosthetic valve dysfunction relevant or is it not? Because this is an endpoint that is completely driven by echocardiography. And we already know that there is this difference between the transprosthetic gradients as measured by echo versus invasively. And invasively, there is no difference or hardly any difference between balloon expandable and self-expanding valves. It only becomes different between the two when you put an echo probe on it. And then the question is, yeah, but is this then what we measure? Is this a limitation of echo or is there something else going on? So I think very important to do the long-term follow-up. And for me, an important limitation of this trial, there were no invasive hemodynamic assessments done.
Well, I agree with you. I think the interest is in the long-term follow-up in terms of gradients. I think that's where you would expect perhaps a difference, and that's it. So to me, if there's no clinical difference...
Will it change our practice at this point?
At this point, no.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. Okay, so let's move on now to thinking out of the box, the PREVENT trial.
PREVENT trial. So PREVENT trial is a long-anticipated trial that assessed whether preventive PCI of vulnerable FFR negative lesions with either BVS or later stage Zine stents resulted in a significant reduction in target vessel failure at 2 years versus optimal medical therapy alone, which you would expect to be standard of care in patients with a FFR negative lesion. So 15 hospitals, 4 countries performed the trial, in Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and New Zealand. Lesions suitable for enrollment in this, this trial were those with a negative FFR, and 2 or more of the following criteria at the operator's discretion, based on the device they used. So 1 was plug burden above 70%, minimal lumen area below 4, or signs of thin cap fibroadenoma, either on OCT, VH, IVIS, LRP, on NIRS with the LCBI above 315. So all criteria that have been linked to plug vulnerability. Interestingly, 5,600 patients were screened with a diameter stenosis above 50%, 83% at stable angina. Also for interest, 40% was FFR positive, so those were of course excluded. And out of the 3,500 patients that were FFR negative, and this to me is more interesting, about 60%, so over 2,000 patients had vulnerable plug features. And that's important because if you would treat these patients with either a BVS or a Zines, and at the end, 1 out of 3 patients still got a BVS, versus OMT, you get a significant reduction in target vessel failure at 2 months with a difference of 3.4 versus 0.4% in absolute figures at 2 years in favor of the preventive PCI strategy. So to me, a very important trial that is first of its kind. To me, now for the first time, demonstrate the additive value of imaging in lesions that are FFR negative. Again, these patients had angina, otherwise they would have never come to the table. They would have sent home with high-dose statins, maybe some aspirin. But in this case, they got a PCI that appeared to prevent a significant number of repeat revascs and perhaps at the long run, even harder clinical endpoints. But for that, the trial was obviously not powered.
I think this is a good trial because this really opens up perspectives and also helps us understand how important invasive imaging is becoming. we'll get to the next trial, and then I think we can maybe add some more perspectives to both of PREVENT and full revasc, because full revasc
is not about imaging but was about physiology. This was a multi-center national registry-based trial, again from the kitchen from Stefan James. So again, credits to him for performing these important large trials within their network in Sweden. The trial was designed to compare a FFR guided complete revascularization strategy versus no further revascularization in patients with non-culprit lesions presenting with either STEMI or high-risk non-STEMI. So there we have to make a small correction to a preview in which I thought that this trial compared FFR-guided complete versus angio-based revascularization. So that was not the case. This trial actually went one step back before COMPLETE and PRAMI and actually again challenged the concept of complete revasc in these patients as compared to a watchful waiting approach in which no aggressive multivessel revascularization was performed in patients, and this is important, with non-culprit lesions of at least 50%. So the trial enrolled 1,545 patients with non-culprit lesions that were, as mentioned, between 50 and 99%, who were randomized then for a primary endpoint of all-cause death, MI, or unplanned revascularization. So 90% of the patients enrolled within the trial were STEMI, so that is a good thing. At 4.8%, and this to me was perhaps a bit surprising, given the design of the trial, which was not comparing FFR to angio-based complete, but FFR to doing nothing, there was no difference in the primary endpoint with an incidence rate of 19% in the FFR-guided complete revasc arm versus 24.4% in the culprit revasc-only group. So virtually overlapping event curves in the two arms with patients that were followed up to 4.8 years. So to me, a bit surprising following PRAMI and COMPLETE and even BioVasc, but a finding that challenges a little bit, again, the way we should approach patients with 50% stenosis, in which a FFR only at the end appeared to be positive in less than 40% of the cases. To me, to put a little bit more nuance to the trial, this trial doesn't really change the practice. I mean, you have patients with 50% lesions. We know angio is unreliable. We know that complete revasc, at least if a lesion is 60 to 80%, significantly improves outcome. And COMPLETE, which enrolled over four times or three to four times as many patients as this trial, by even reducing death and MI, so not just repeat revasc. This trial with the 1,500 patients, I think, was underpowered to detect a meaningful differences in death and repeat MI. But that said, I think the future is more in a PREVENT-like strategy in which you use imaging to assess the vulnerability of these lesions and decide on whether or not it makes sense to do to opt for a complete revascularization strategy in patients with multivessel disease in an ACS setting.
Yeah, that's also the big picture for me. I think we need to get better and have a higher uptake of invasive imaging because we need to know about these plaques. Yeah. I think the anatomy per se doesn't tell us everything, but the same thing, this number of coronary physiology, yeah. I think the clinical relevance is becoming more and more a controversy. Yeah. And I see this, we have been talking about this before, I see our field moving more and more towards a more generalized uptake of intravascular imaging and then move away a little bit from coronary physiology. This may be provocative, but I think this is a negative study.
Yeah, a small nuance to your points, which I in general tend to agree with, but the point here is that these are patients presenting with STEMI. So it's a different entity of patients, typically higher vulnerable plaque criteria. So that's a different animal than those presenting with stable angina, which is a substantial.
But we talk about ACS, We talk about ACS.
I agree. No.
So in ACS, I think there is much more research to be done. Again, a lot of the research has focused in terms of invasive imaging on IVUS. I think a couple of more OCT studies might also be beneficial in this in this arena. So more to follow on that in the future.
Yeah. Okay. Danger shock.
Yes, danger shock was probably one of the highlights of the ACC. Patients with a STEMI and cardiogenic shock and an ejection fraction less than 45% were randomized to Impella or standard of care. 355 patients with a mean age of 67 years old, 80% men, ejection fraction 25%, 70% with multivessel disease were enrolled in the study. 55% of the patients had a cardiogenic shock Sky C, 28 Sky D, and 16 Sky E. I think with the recent ECLS shock trial in mind, you want to make the comparison. So in ECLS shock, more than one in three of all patients were in Sky E. So those patients were a little bit further more out advanced in their cardiogenic shock. And what was an important exclusion criteria for this trial was either one, RV failure, but also patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest who remained comatose. So if you had patients who required 30 minutes of CPR and then were intubated and ventilated, they were not eligible for the study. And I think that is so powerful. And we already alluded to that upfront in our preview. That will drive the study. And this is, I think, why the DanGer Shock trial became a positive trial. Why a positive trial? Because Impella resulted, so at least 2.5 days of Impella support resulted in a significant reduction in mortality. And this is, I think, for the first time that we have a positive trial in the context of cardiogenic shock. So the mortality was 46% in the treatment arm versus 58.5% in the control arm. But we also were cautioning about a signal of harm, and that definitely was there in the study. There was this safety endpoint of severe bleeding, limb ischemia, hemolysis, device failure, worsening AR. That occurred in one in four of the patients that received an Impella. One in four, that's quite high. And the numbers of bleeding were double in the treatment arm versus the control arm, 22% versus 11%. And that was quite high for a 14 French system. Mm-hmm. That was a little bit of a surprise to me. It may create questions about, okay, but what was the antithrombotic regimen then that was applied? Were they very aggressive in terms of heparin use, for instance? Because if you look at the ECLS shock trial, the major bleeding rate was only 23% versus now 24%. So obviously, with an ECMO device, you use the French size of the cannulas is much bigger than the 14 French. So what happened there? And also, renal replacement therapy was required in 42% of all the patients in the Impella arm versus 26% in the control arm. Well, if we put that in perspective of ECLS shock, only 8% required renal replacement therapy. So remarkable findings in terms of the safety of using the technology. At the same time, you had a clear win in terms of all-cause mortality. The number needed to treat was 8. The number needed to harm was 6. And I think this is an important observation of the trial. It tells us that the use of Impella is not for all the interventional, all the cath labs in the world. You need to be very experienced, you need to be trained. Operators need to be able to have a proper large bore access site management. And only then, I think, you will make a difference with the adoption of mechanical circulatory support in patients with shock. Obviously, if you then look at hospital stay and ICU stay, all longer in the Impella arm, but obviously there's a very important survival bias there. Yeah. And then also kudos to the investigators because it took more than 10 years to get this study enrolled. The first patient was entered in the trial in January 2013. The last patient was entered in July 2023. So definitely a study that requires some stamina among the investigators in Denmark and added by investigators from Germany and the UK.
Yeah, important trial. Do you have any details? Or you find any details on the time to pump running pump? So the time between onset of shock and the time the pump was actually activated?
Well, they did mention that one of the requirements was that the patients could not be in shock for more than 24 hours. So that is important. And also the time of randomization was important. So 57% of the patients, they were randomized prior to the PCI. Mm-hmm. And of these patients, the Impella was already attempted in 89% prior to the PCI. Mm. And that is also different from what happened in ECLS shock, yeah. Because there 50% of the patients were only treated with their ECLS after the PCI. Yeah. So that tells you something about the timing mm-hmm. of the use mm-hmm. of MCS. And, yeah. and I agree with you, that is a very important aspect of MCS yeah. treatment, right? Yeah. Timing.
Yeah, I think that is something we need to dig into a little bit more to perhaps even find greater benefits in these patients.
Yeah, and then obviously we can finish the wrap-up with a trial on renal denervation, right?
Yes, absolutely. So that's something we try to end with every preview and wrap-up, as long as there are new trials. And at the ACC, there was a important new trial. That was the Target BP randomized controlled trial. So David Kanzari presented the results of this sham-controlled randomized controlled trial testing the effect of alcohol-mediated renal denervation on blood pressure in the presence of antihypertensive drugs. So this was the on-med counterpart of the off-med trial that was published in Urine Intervention by Atul Patak last year, not able, by the way, to show a significant blood pressure lowering effect at 8 weeks. So that is an important thing to consider when looking at these trial data. So that's peculiar, right? I mean, you take patients off their drugs, you test for the true effect of the device with no interference of the drugs, and you don't find any change in blood pressure significantly lower as compared to a sham arm. That said, small trial. This was the bigger trial, 300 patients with uncontrolled hypertension on a mean of 2 to 5 antihypertensive medications. Office blood pressure around 165, randomized 1:1 to either alcohol or sham control for a primary endpoint of change in mean 24-hour APPM from baseline to 3 months. So guess what? The trial, as already predicted based on the press release the company issued a couple of months ago, the trial appeared to be positive with a significant reduction in blood pressure in the RDN group as compared to the sham. However, the result was quite modest. Mm-hmm. So the delta in the 24-hour ABPM was only 3.2 millimeters of mercury, which was driven by a numerical decrease in blood pressure of 10 millimeters of mercury in the treatment arm, which is somewhere where you would like to see it or where you would expect the effect of RDN. However, 6.8 to 8 in the sham arm. And that is a little bit awkward because we have rarely seen sham controlled trials with a decrease in blood pressure of 8 millimeters of mercury in the sham arm. So a positive trial, but a result with a p-value, by the way, mind you, 0.049, mm-hmm. so just borderline significant, that is not too convincing. Mm-hmm. And this tells me several things. First, it is a positive trial. But second, it again demonstrates the difficulty of running a proper trial in eliminating the bias of medication. If patients use more than 2 to 3 drugs, they are non-adherent. And that's what the investigators nicely demonstrated within this trial. Less than 50% of patients were fully adherent to their regimen of 2 to 5 drugs, which generates and produces an enormous bias on the results in terms of how patients may respond to a device-based therapy. That's one. Second, on top of that, I think there should be more trials to test the efficacy of this technology, perhaps also in a trial in which a polypill is embedded in order to more streamline the antihypertensive therapy in patients on medication. So a positive trial, but I don't think it will be the last in the ablative solution series.
I think one of the important things you said are the value of this polypill, right? Mm-hmm. That will definitely improve the adherence and compliance with patients. And then I agree, we will need more trials to get this kind of technology in the treatment armamentarium of patients with hypertension.
Yeah, and this is a very appealing technology, right? Mm-hmm. It's there's no need for generator, no electricity. It was extremely safe. It's a simple catheter, 0.6 cc of ethanol in, out, you're done. I mean, it's extremely simple, it's fast, mm-hmm. and if it works, I think it could be a strong competitor to the ReCor Medtronic technologies.
All right, thank you very much, Joost. We close the wrap-up of ACC 2024. Mm. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you for the preview of EuroPCR coming up soon. Thank you, and goodbye.
Thank you, bye-bye.